You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode number 59 and I am your host, Thomas Smith. Wow, can't wait to get to today's interview. This is Alex Jules. He's someone I should have had on the show a long time ago. Can't believe we haven't gotten around to doing something until now, but it's worth it. It's been worth the wait. Really good stuff. Alex is a fantastic speaker, really interesting guy. We talked for just forever and recorded some of it. but yeah, there was so much to talk about. And we already, as a matter of fact, have scheduled another recording. So despite the fact that we didn't get to everything that we wanted to, don't worry. There's plenty more on the way between the two of us, I think. It's been really fun. So with that said, let me get you over to the conversation with Alex Jules. Joining me now is Alex Jules. Alex, how you doing?
I'm doing okay, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great. We've been gabbing on for like a half hour off mic because it is really good to talk to you. It's been a pleasure getting to know you a little bit because I can't believe we haven't really interacted before. So really excited to have you on the show. And I know I posted on Facebook, having you on, give us questions, and we got a ton of feedback there. So I think the excitement is all around. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm honored.
And boy, I was thinking we've got a lot to talk about, definitely. So I want to keep this short, but you gave me a little picture of your backstory. But I wonder if you give me the Reader's Digest version, as they say, of how you got into this whole thing. Because I was surprised to find out that, you know, you work all the time. You just do this out of the certain goals that you have. And I thought that was an interesting story. So do you mind giving us that a little bit?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. I'm doing this because of my kids. A couple of years ago, we decided that we're going to bring Camp Quest Texas to Camp Quest to Texas. And my kids were like, yay, we're going to go to camp and we don't have to deal with prayer, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I had started building a community here. And it's actually one of the largest atheist and free thinking communities now. But it was like, hey, let's do this for the kids. And my son was interviewed by the news media because, of course, it's big news. Yeah. Secular camp in Texas. Now, this is about 5.5, 6 years ago. And it was all fine and dandy until they said, hey, let's interview your son. He was about 13, 14 at the time. And they decided that they were going to broadcast it. It's fine. And was like, wait, this might cause a little bit of a problem for my son. Now, we lived in a very diverse area, but the local high school is, you know, I want to say that it was only maybe about 13-14% African American. And that was in August, September, October, no issues. We didn't think anything of it. And then come around the December, January timeframe, it turns out that a couple of the local churches saw that interview and were using that interview as a recruiting tool because the atheists are coming for your kids.
Oh, wow.
Right. And that happened. And I hadn't heard about it yet, but a couple of kids cornered my son and said, you know, and they roughed him up a little bit. And they said, hey, you're black. You can't be an atheist. How can you not believe in Jesus? The school itself did what it needed to do. I wasn't unhappy with the school. But when looking at this idea that they were dealing with, it was like, hey, you're black and an atheist. That doesn't happen. That can't happen. Mm-hmm. And I could have been mad at the kids, but then I said, you know, I could really be mad at them, but what if I try and change the narrative a little bit? So that's when I became much more active, much more vocal. You know, the billboards happened, the magazines happened afterwards, et cetera. And, you know, I'm trying to change the world a little bit at a time so that my kids don't have to face the nonsense that I had to deal with growing up, or moving away from the Black community as being a Black atheist. And the good news is it's kind of changed within the Black community. It's not as taboo anymore. You are beginning to see some really big magnets and higher visibility Black atheists out there. And that's cool. So yeah, that's why I do this. It's all about making sure that my kids don't have to deal with it anymore.
Yeah, trying to change the culture a little bit. Because one thing that I have discovered, I think that a lot of the comments I'm seeing is that they want me to white-splain a bunch of stuff to you. So I'm going to go. That has been something that I consider a personal growth experience for me, which is realizing that I have one perspective. I do my best to gather as much as I can. Of course, I read a lot. I want to talk to people, but I have my perspective. I have my upbringing, and I have no idea what it's like to grow up as a Black man, to grow up as a, by the way, as a Black atheist, as you were talking about, something that's got to be a whole different mix of like, what community are you in? You know, people, as you referenced there, the Black community not accepting in some ways you and your kids. So that's something that I am just so excited to talk to you about. What do you think that your typical white guy, maybe your typical white atheist, your typical me say, what am I missing in my experience? Like what is it that my privileged position has not allowed me to see? What do you think?
I think the big one is the fact that we exist and that everything's equal. A lot of times I see arguments from equality and they want to say, well, I don't see race, I'm colorblind, and I don't want to talk to my kids about race, et cetera. And there's a massive amount of erasure that happens when you do that. But also it doesn't, especially when you're dealing with the kids, you're not teaching your kids about these cultural differences. Would we be doing it if we said that Black was more than just skin tone and more of a culture, which, by the way, it is. There are African-American experiences that are cultural and very culturally different than white experiences, or the Afro-Caribbean experience, which happens to be very different from the African-American experience. That's actually where I grew up in the as an Afro-Caribbean Black male living in almost a shadow realm of what it was like to be African American. So I dealt with the pushes and different ideas about race from my Caribbean family, and they had their predispositions and notions of what Black Americans are really like, et cetera. I mean, there was this entire struggle, and I'm trying to fit into this culture. So don't erase me. Acknowledge that I'm there. Yes, we have some differences. And those differences sometimes are more important to us than what binds us. And I'm thinking about the atheist community specifically. A lot of times we get this big push. We should all be under this big, huge banner. And why can't we all just get along? Well, because, yeah, we agree that, sure, being an atheist is important and pushing that narrative is important. But if you are a humanist, and I do identify as a humanist as well, oppression is one of the things that pops up immediately for me. Black lives, and how do they matter? What is their wealth? What is the worth of a Black life is very important to me. And often I will get, well, I don't see race. Can we not pull race into this? Well, it's fine that we can talk about humanism and atheism, but cops don't stop me in the street because I'm an atheist. They don't pull me over because I'm a humanist. They pull me over because of the first thing that they see. And it's built on this racial hierarchy that just exists in America. It always has. It's from the founding. I mean, I'm 3/5 until I was 4/5, until I was still striving to be that 5/5 of a human being.
Mm, yeah. Let me know what you think on this, because that's something I've had to fight against too in a lot of comments I'm getting lately, because I merely use the word white-splaining, and I set off a lot of people on that. I was a little bit naive. I didn't realize that so many people would be, I guess, offended by me using that word. Give me your take on this. I think that what might be an issue with the saying, hey, why can't we just not look at race, is that I think a lot of white people don't realize the status quo does favor white people. And so when you're trying to do this thing of, well, it's all even, let's just not even talk about race, or let's not, why are you always bringing it up? that already favors one set of people. Do you think I'm on the right direction there? Because that's kind of how I've been thinking of it lately.
Well, yeah, there's this privilege of, yeah, of being blinded by your own race, by your own status. There was this wonderful meme, is you're privileged enough not to have to see race. And that's right. Really what the problem is. When I walk into a store, am I going to get followed regardless of what I'm wearing, et cetera? Well, it depends on the place. But, you know, if I walk in with a friend, is that going to happen? And this actually happened to me, of course. I do a lot of public speaking where, and I think probably a couple of your listeners know this, because I've told this story before, but how many, and I've reached out to other public speakers, other atheist speakers, and I've said, how many of you have had to deal with security being called on you as a speaker because someone assumed that you weren't a speaker because you were Black? They immediately assumed that I was a Black minister that came in to cause a problem. It's like, I'm right on the docket. I'm wearing a suit and tie because I know that I'm talking to 700 plus white people that for them, this may be the very first time that they're interacting with Black people, which is true. It was a Midwest conference. And we tend to forget this reality.
I can't even imagine that. that's so right. Weird.
Right. Well, but the numbers don't show that we are an integrated country, right? There's only 13% African-Americans in the country, 13%. And they're very much condensed in various pockets. So when white people say, oh, I have 9 friends, it's like, unless you've got the same 9 friends as every other white person out there, you're lying. Because if I grabbed a cross-section of Americans at 10 people in a room right now, that's roughly 1 Black person, 7 to 8 white people, and then everyone else in between. So don't tell me that you all, you know Alex. Oh yeah, Alex is my friend. Do you know Craig? Craig and him? No. It's not the same Craig. It's you know, so, and we are very racially segregating, whether it comes to the schools or work. I mean, the statistics.
Yeah, even within a city too. You know, like not just like, oh, rural area versus city. I would say, yeah, even within a city, it's like, it seems like we're very stratified.
When I grew up in New York, I grew up in Brooklyn, and New York City in the 70s, 80s, 90s. And until I went to high school, which was in the 90s, I didn't have regular interaction with white people at all. I just grew up in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Now, when I got into high school, then I was introduced to America. It's like, oh, America's, you know, it's 70% white. I'm like, oh, okay. Right. But my interactions with diverse ethnicities and cultures, that didn't happen until I left. And I thought I was fine. In fact, that's part of the my religious story. You know, I identified as a Black Christian because everyone identified as a Black Christian until I went to Islam and looked at that as well. And then eventually I found my path to spirituality, spiritual but not religious. And then eventually after that, I became, you know, the atheist and the person that I am today. But we tend to segregate. Part of it is self-segregation. We've always done this. Some of it is human. But we got rid of legal segregation on paper in some instances. You take a look at one of the things that people always hit me up with. Well, racism died with the civil rights era.
Right.
Well, that's so not true because, you know, we're talking about the civil rights.
There was
rights
that Republican who tweeted something like that.
Yeah.
Recently,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. It was like, oh, well, yes. Hey guys, remember racism? Boy, that sucked back in the day, huh? Okay.
It was horrific, which ignores the fact that, and we're talking about 65 through 67 when the laws were there and being implemented, the Voting Rights Act just stopped. Made it illegal for you to lynch someone when they were trying to go out there and vote. A Black person was trying to go out there and vote. But that didn't stop the zoning laws that restricted housing. You know, okay, so this person lived in a project, but they couldn't leave the projects until the 80s. This person lived in this area in Brooklyn. Well, they couldn't leave that area and get into, you know, certain areas in New York, which were zoned whether it's a legal zoning ordinance or whether it was a housing association that just wouldn't let them in, they weren't let in. In fact, the president of the United States had a case that was, you know, very similar. Like, okay, you're discriminating against renters. It's not that they can't pay, it's that they're black. So that didn't die in the 60s. In fact, there were tons of cases in the 80s and into the 90s that were cases against FHA and HUD, and even Sally, Susie Mac, when people were trying to get loans, and not even talking about the ridiculous interest rates that people of color are exposed to, just not getting the loans at all.
Yeah.
So you can't undo that. I'm going to get it right. It was Freddie Mac. You can't undo that in the 40, 50 year time frame that's happened. People that were raising kids in the 60s that fought against integration raised kids in the 60s that believed that people shouldn't be integrated. So you had many races that were raising racist kids. Yes, maybe they got a little bit less racist, but guess what? They were still a little racist, and they raised racist kids. And one of the things that I often talk about in my talks are what the racial surveys tend to show. And just between generation and generation, we've only seen, when it comes to anti-black sentiment, we've only seen, you know, 3 to 4% differences between baby boomers and Gen X. So we haven't been able to, And we're talking about blacks are lazy, et cetera. I mean, so true anti-black sentiment,
right,
not the implicit bias stuff.
This is explicit stuff.
This is very explicit. Do you clutch your pearls? Not that. Do you believe that blacks are lazy? Do you believe all that stuff shows of a marginal improvement?
Wow.
Again, I think honesty is the big point and big picture here, because if we go back to starting there and realizing that that's where we're at, it's a different kind of narrative. It's a different conversation that we should be having versus post-racial Americas. Like, people haven't even died off from that generation.
Yeah.
There's, Orrin Hatch. You've had Klansmen that.
Well, and you got Jeff Sessions, by the way. Probably doing the most harm of anyone in the government right now, possibly.
Well, between Jeff Sessions and Nancy DeVos, I think that's where you know, it's like how bad do you want it? Because if you look at
Betsy
DeVos, yeah. Do you want to look at what she's going to do to HBCUs and to public schools where minorities are very much dependent on those? Or do you want to talk about the continued criminalization of skin color, which is exactly what Jeff Sessions wants to do? All you have to do is look at what he says when he's out on the trail.
Yeah. You know, it's so hard because there's so much I would love to get your take on. There's so many places I want to go. But I do want to ask you, if you don't mind, could you give us some info on what it's like to be a black atheist, and why is it so, I suppose, either rare or difficult or whatever for black people to become or come out as atheists? And is that changing? Give us some background on that.
It's identity. It really is. It's identity and identity coherence. There are only certain roles that you get to play. We're told, if you're a black man, there's only certain things that you can do. You fall outside of those parameters and you're no longer a black man. And some of them are toxic, right? Same thing with black women. And there are these roles that we've developed internally. There is these roles that are almost written for us by white America or America in general. But when you take a look at racial identity, what does that mean? Well, yeah, we have the stereotypes and you have the sub-stereotypes, et cetera, but you have these identities that we cohere, and part of them is, you know, religion and race tend to get intertwined. We see it with Islam and Muslims from the Middle East. We tend to see that kind of coherence. True, you have a lot more of diversity of that in the United States, where whites, can be Protestant or Catholic, but even there, like, what does it mean to be a Southern white male? Well, you're probably Southern, Baptist or a Protestant of some sort. And once you fall out of those, you're weird. So you fall into the out-group category. So being a black person who identifies as an atheist, part of it is often people will question whether I still identify as Black, because you're turning away from your ancestors, you're turning away from identity. You know, you sometimes become a race traitor.
And are you feeling that? You're feeling that from the Black community. You're saying like
that's just from the Black community. Right. I mean, and this has been around for a while, because once you get a little bit of education, you know, oh, now you don't believe in God, you're too good to be Black, et cetera. Mm. So these are some of the narratives there. Now that's just from the Black community. On that front, it's still getting a little bit better. You know, when you take a look at the general population in the United States, we're getting a little bit more secular. If you like the Pew number of 30-ish% and it's getting bigger, you know, potentially up to 40%, that's great. That's not the numbers that we see in the Latino or Latinx and African-American community. We're still seeing religious coherence at 90 to 95%. And yeah, you got to keep it real. You got to be you, but you is defined by X. So you got to at least believe in something is the typical narrative. And then you get to cross into the atheist sphere, and that's the general population. When you're dealing with white atheists, it's been a different experience for me. I'm used to code switching. I deal with you know, whites on a daily basis. I mean, I've been
in. What do you mean by that? What's that? What do you mean by that term?
Well, I've been. You know, I'm gonna get to that. I've been in corporate America for almost 21 years now, and I'm usually. It's only happened a couple of years that I haven't been the only Black person, either in my department or in a room or whatever. It just happens. There are just not many of us, you know, out there, and so being able to have a conversation and switch dialect really quick is something that many Black people learn to do. I could walk in the street and have a conversation that sounds really off, especially if you're in Brooklyn, like, oh, what is he saying? And then I walk into a building and all of a sudden people say, oh, he sounds quite white. And I was like, no, it's I know how to communicate and have a conversation for the audiences that I'm talking to. And so we just call that code switching.
Oh, okay. This is so fascinating, because it's weird timing. I'm going to have to explain it a tiny bit. We're recording just before I will have done my Thursday episode of last week. And I need to mention that because I got a call, a voicemail, and a topic about African-American vernacular English. And it's so fascinating because I someone sent me a video like, here, watch this, learn about this. I watched it and they talked about how, yeah, a lot of Black people in America are kind of, it's not like bilingual, but it's like bi-dialectical.
Exactly.
It's so fascinating. It's just something, a topic I didn't really know about. And it's interesting timing to learn more about it. So that's something that you do. You just...
It's thoroughly multi-dialectical, because I'm walking in there. If I'm walking into a room with a bunch of execs, I'm talking one language. I'm out there with my friends, I'm talking a different language. And then as soon as I step into the room with my mom, that's a different language altogether.
I'm sure people can relate to that to a certain extent, like changing how they're speaking to a certain extent. But I think I'm guessing it's got to be way more pronounced than I'm used to dealing with. It's a whole different dialect.
It is.
And how do you feel about that? Do you feel like that's good, bad, neutral? Is there any way you want that to change, or is it fine? I'm just curious.
It's always insulting when I walk into a room and I start having a conversation with someone and someone says, oh, you sound so white. I'm like, yeah, good. Okay, whatever.
Maybe don't say you sound so white.
Don't say that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Don't
this
say
bad.
That.
Okay.
Got it. That's bad. And I quite often I'll hear something like, but he's so eloquent or something like that. He speaks so well. I mean, look at my education. What do you expect? But even then, being able to go from room to room it's a skill that many of us have learned and we've been able to hone it over years of living in a country where we have multiple identities. When we talk about, you know, walking in with a hood and a hoodie on, it's like, yeah, I walk with a hoodie on and has a Harvard tag on top of it. But people still see me as, that's that Black guy. So that tends to be, you know, the immediate code switching that needs to happen. And America makes race almost the first thing for at least Black people. It tends to be a racial issue just all across the board. But for Black people, it's, you know, you're Black something. So, Yeah, I'd love for people to just drop that from their vernacular altogether. You sound so white. But I also get that from Black people as well. I'll be on the phone with them and then they'll meet me. It's like, oh my God, you're Black. I was like, yes, I'm Black. Yes. Just because I can have a conversation with you and code switch, et cetera. But again, this is something that we're learned, and the cultural biases we just inherit. A lot of them, if they are not challenged, they just stick and they don't go away, which is exactly why you have so many issues in the South where people are like, okay, we desegregated. No, they didn't. But we legally desegregated. I actually had this conversation not too long ago. The school district in Mississippi that just desegregated in 2017.
Wow.
Just in 2017. That's America, and people are like, oh my goodness, I'm so surprised. I'm
can
like,
do you have a link for that? I can put for people great. I can read about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were forced to desegregate in 2016, and then they decided that they were going to fight it in court. And in 2017, in January, February of 2017, they said, okay, we're not going to fight it. Just let, you know, we'll do that. And then the same school district decided that there was a Black valedictorian, right? And there was a Black valedictorian, but because they didn't want to disrupt the status quo, they appointed a white co-valedictorian, not salutatorian, but a co-valedictorian. Wow. Even though the Black valedictorian had a higher GPA. It's just, this is still America. So this is the America that I know. It's just like when people said, there's no way Trump wins. I was like, just wait.
Who was that? Was that Chappelle? Oh my God, it was so great.
Yes.
I think it was on SNL. It might have been an SNL skit.
It was Chris
or
Rock. It was Chris Rock that did the skit. And I think it was Chris Rock and David Chappelle.
Yeah, them together, right? Yeah.
Them together.
Where everybody, all the white people are like, no way. No way.
Well, I went to a Trump rally last year. This was back in February of last year. And, you know, because I was on another podcast and I made some statements and people called me out and says, how do you know? You've never been. I'm like, okay, well, if this means that I'm going to have to go to a Trump rally to prove it, I'm going to go to a Trump rally. And so I did. And I was getting texts from people, please don't do it. Even my conservative friends, I was like, okay.
They were like worried for your safety.
They were worried. I was like, wait, I thought you said I didn't have anything to worry about.
Yeah. And you called their bluff. They're like, okay.
It's like, wait, we don't want you to die. I mean, we just want you to be wrong. Don't die.
You got us. Now, yeah, no, don't go. Okay.
And so I went, and what I saw was this cross section of America, of white America, specifically white America. That I was like, this is not what the media is painting. These aren't the Hicks. These aren't the, you know, I was expecting to see a lot more overalls and denim and all that. And I was like, and missing teeth, because this is what media was saying. This is what a Trump supporter looked like. And I got there and I immediately knew. I was like, he's going to win, because this is a cross section of angry white voters, and they're angry for different reasons, whether it's the establishment. We now know that there was an underlying tone of white nationality. You know, that's something that's been kind
it's
of circling.
Not that underlying, though, to be honest.
Well,
with you.
It's pretty
overlying too when you talk about building a wall and keeping the anyway. Go ahead.
You know, I 100% agree, but you know, people will tone police you and tell you sure, like, that's not productive language. I'm going to get emails over that.
Maybe from a few.
It's not productive language. And it's like, okay, that's fine. But understand that when you say that, you know, you had white, you know, you had this economic anxiety. Well, what was that economic anxiety really, really tied to? And it's like, them taking your jobs. Okay, who's taking your jobs? We're not talking about another white person. You're talking about a Black or a brown person. When we're talking about entitlement, it's like, they're getting stuff that's mine. It's like, well, you're talking about welfare, aren't you? It doesn't matter that the overwhelming majority of recipients of welfare and SNAP, et cetera, happen to be white. It doesn't matter because the narrative that was put out there with Reagan has never gone away. Even if Reagan didn't put it out, you know, I wouldn't have been surprised if Bush used it as a narrative, or any politician would have used it as a narrative for their Southern strategy, because that's what the voters want to hear. You're suffering because of X, not because of me, but because of X. So here you go. So America's always going, I've said it before, America's always going to need a black person. And by black person, I mean nigger. And specifically that idea of what a black person
is. A scapegoat.
A scapegoat.
Okay.
And it's more than a scapegoat. It is very, very specific. It is very specific.
Yeah. You know what's so interesting too about that, something I heard the other day, is now if you talk to those same people, those same Trump supporters, magically the economy, it's better. It's if you ask their opinion,
it's all fine.
And it turns out they just don't want a black man running the country. They need their guy in control. Nothing on the ground, no facts on the ground have changed. There's no time. There simply hasn't been the time for any economic swing or any economic policy to make any sort of difference. But you poll all of them and all of a sudden they're like, oh, yeah, the economy's fine. It's funny how not motivated by reality a lot of these beliefs are. The belief is just, okay, if liberals are controlled, the economy is shit. And if conservatives are controlled, the economy is better. And vice versa. So it's such an imaginary land, fairy tale land that they're living.
I got one for you because if anyone follows me on Facebook, I'll occasionally do what I call a Starbucks Chronicle. And what happens is I live in Texas and I live in a Dallas suburb, and it tends to be a little bit more purple than red. It's not truly blue, but
yeah, Texas is moving a little that way, right?
It is very much, and Dallas is blue-ish, and then outside, when you go out there, it still has some conservatism there. So we're seeing a lot more purple, and people are saying by 2020 it'll flip, from purple possibly.
Greatest thing in my life would be if in 2018 we get Ted Cruz out of there and it flips. I've said on opening arguments that would be the only thing that would kind of make the Trump thing like slightly less horrible is if it resulted in getting Ted Cruz out of the Senate and then we had the numbers to impeach Trump after that. But anyway, that's just a fairy tale.
Okay. So I do these Starbucks Chronicles, and sometimes I just go to my local Starbucks, which has a lot of conservative traffic. And so I'll just listen to what they say. There's a great one about Benghazi and this couple having a conversation about, who this Benghazi fella is. And it's,
is that real? Oh my gosh.
That was for real. I mean, if anybody, yeah. And today, what I overheard, it was actually saddening. I had to sit down and reflect on it because I was like, did they really say this? All right. So right now, what we're seeing in the news is Donald Trump Jr. may have potentially colluded.
He definitely colluded. Anyway, go ahead.
We gotta wait because now you're dealing with legal terms, and is it really collusion? I guess it's collusion all day long.
Listen to opening arguments when you're everybody for that expertise, legal expertise.
I can't wait to hear Andrew's take on it.
Yeah,
but what I heard was, and I'm hoping you're sitting down for this one. Mm-hmm. Winning at all cost is also the American way.
Yep.
He did what he needed done to make America great. And that's the difference. Liberals can't. He's a patriot, not a traitor.
That is like a word for word Sean Hannity kind of. That is the byline. That is the talking point now. And it's just unbelievable. Like I didn't know that things were this bad, and maybe that's more of the white privilege talking, probably white liberal privilege. I just didn't know that reality didn't matter anymore. Like that was the big thing of this last year. Like it just doesn't matter what he does, what Trump does, what his son does, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that literally everything Trump does, he has a tweet from 2012 or 2013 or whatever condemning Barack Obama for doing it. I had no idea that facts and reality just do not matter to like 39% of the country at least.
Well, not only do you have that, you had the recent survey that shows that 58% of Republicans think that colleges do more harm
That's a byproduct of the campus craziness narrative that Fox News has been pushing, and you've seen Rubin pushing. All these other people who pretend to be liberals are pushing. There's consequences to it. This is something I just became aware of, and that's real life consequences to a constant narrative. Like, that's what Fox News does, and it's so harmful.
Yeah, and when we're looking at it, it's let's find the most extreme examples and portray that as the norm, because I look in and I see what happens on these campuses, and I tried tracking them. I was like, okay, how many of these are actually done versus how many campuses actually exist in the United States versus how many students are actually enrolled? And I'm coming up with extraordinarily small numbers. And, you know, would this actually happen in this state, in this state, in this state, in this state? Can I imagine this happening at NYU, for instance? No, this never happens. But the narrative, you know, Shapiro does it, et cetera. The narrative is, you know, as you said, campus craziness. You know, you have these
so
ultra.
Great. Oh, it's so great. Alex, I think it's a chance. I can white-splain to you here. Oh, let me white-splain. So great. Here's what I think is going on with the white community. Let me tell you about my fellow white people, Alex. It is such a good victim narrative. It's a delicious victim. It is. Here's what it is. It's all these white people that watch Fox News. They get to think like there's this stereotype they have in their mind, which is an older white professor. He's got the tweed jacket, you know, maybe he smokes a pipe. I don't know. And he's all about reason and rationality, and he's all about facts. And all he's trying to do is teach some shitty kids, some know nothing, ungrateful millennials about his facts and figures and whatever topics they probably don't even know a real college course, but anyway, whatever it is. And they're screaming at him. And it's such a good victim narrative, because it's like, yes, we're under fire. We can't even just be white people anymore. We'll get screamed at. It's so great. It's such an attractive narrative to a lot of white people.
Well, this is where, you know, I look at that and I'm like, okay, so I understand that people believe that the left is destroying, you know, the world, and we do all this infighting, blah, 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 blah. And then I take a look at, okay, so let's take a look at what the actual power dynamics look like. Can we, you know, it's just like, you know, people blaming, you know, Bernie supporters, Green, and that's a different conversation altogether. Yeah. We ain't got time for that. But it's like, can we also talk about the 63 million people that voted Trump?
Yeah.
Because 63 million people voted Trump. And that's about half, a little bit over half of the people that voted. So I understand that you want to talk about, you know, this problem, and it's not that we shouldn't be looking at getting better, but 63 million people still voted Trump, just like they will decide that they're going to do something in unity again, which is stand behind their bad decision. And we are, you know, it's funny because, you know, people say we're eating each other and we're cannibalizing or we're going after each other. You know how they do that? They talk about it by going after each other. Yeah. So it's a perfect storm. So until you actually, you know, start talking about the real problem and not just these extreme cases, then all you're doing is going around in circles, or you're doing their job for them.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying.
The campus craziness is such a good deflection tool for Fox News. It's absolutely perfect. And here's the thing. I'll have to say this now, and I bet you'll agree. Maybe you'll go. I don't know. There's plenty of examples of 19, 20 year old kids being stupid. Like, there's plenty of examples.
I'm gonna stop you. I'm gonna stop you right there, because I've been challenged before when I talk about black victims who are 18. I've been told that they're no longer a child. Ooh. They are an adult. So don't sit there and tell me that a 18, 19, and 20 year old kid is making this decision for them. No, you're talking about an 18, 19, and 20-year-old adult. And so you are stepping in this patriarchal form. And yes, we can use that term, white patriarchy. I hate that. But yes, white patriarchy coming in and saying, no, this is what I think you should be speaking about. How does it affect me? It doesn't. But it does affect this legacy that I feel as if I bought. This is America. This is what I want America to continue to look like. So I'm going to tell you what you're going to teach. I'm telling you that you do not have a voice in consuming the education for you, because again, you're just an infant. You're a kid until you're black and you're 18 and you're shot and you're an adult.
Yeah,
and
you're 16
or 16 yeah, exactly. or 15 yeah. or you're 12 Great and point. You're playing with a gun. You're playing with a gun and they thought that you were dangerous. Adult and you get shot. So no, it great can't point. Be one of the
other. No, 100% right. That's one of another big kind of everyday, I suppose, racism kind of thing, or just prejudicial kind of thing is white people or even all of our society perceives young black men as bigger, older, more threatening, all these kinds of things than equivalent white people. And it has a real effect on policing. And absolutely.
Absolutely. And when we start dealing with, you know, I feared for my life. I was like, why did you fear for life? Well, it was a black kid. What do you expect? I mean, right. I feared for my life. It's scary. This hurt Hillary Clinton a little bit when she was talking about the super predators. Doesn't matter what the reality of the time was. That's something that was easily played and it hurt her. Absolutely. And it does.
Let me ask you this. Okay. Now this is a separate topic, but do you really think that hurt her or do you think, because I don't think that hurt her with people of color much. Do you? Well, you would know better, but like, because I think that was something used by white Bernie supporters to say, don't vote for her because she's a racist. When in reality, like my decision process was, well, one of these two candidates that we get to choose from will be a fucking disaster for black people. And the other said some bad shit at some point and probably has some problematic views somewhere along the line, but is in support of all kinds of programs that are going to be better for people of color in America. So I don't know. How much of a knock did you see that as on Hillary's?
I thought Hillary actually had two really big hits. And it did hurt the youth vote, and specifically the activist vote, black activists that are going out there, the ones that are in the street, the ones that are talking about it. One is the fact that she had the last name Clinton, and
yeah, that's true.
You know, Bill Clinton's mass incarceration bill, crime bill, that turned into a very one-sided vehicle to help with mass incarceration. So that was one, and we started talking about that very early, and then the other one being the super predator comment. Mm-hmm. So both of those really did help, or actually hurt her. Now, it doesn't really matter because I can't blame black people for Hillary losing because they still showed up. I can talk about 53% of white women that voted for Trump. I can talk about, again, the 63 million people that did vote for Trump. And it was a very, very small number of African-Americans that did vote for Trump. But they did, just like you had Latinos, et cetera. They did that. And some of them were the anti-establishment votes. And there were angry votes because, yes, you have Clinton, but I'm going to vote and I'm angry, damn it. And I'm going to do this. Regardless of what the impact or implications were on everybody else, Yeah. So, yes, it hurt her a little bit. Hurt the narrative. It didn't make it easier.
But what do you think about the primary, though? Because it was so interesting that Bernie just could not get non-white voters. You know, it seemed like. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, that's easy. I mean, he was not, with everything that he's done. He still has no name recognition. He hasn't been in the streets. Although he's been in the streets and people are going to show me pictures. Look, he's right here. No, that's nice. He was in the street. But when you have Bill Clinton on Arsenio Hall, you have Hillary Clinton, you know, going on and talking to Wendy Williams and going on to these black shows, that kind of accessibility and talking to the black community through the church, et cetera. That was very hard for, that'd be hard for anybody to overcome. I mean, Eddie Murphy maybe, you know, was able to beat that. But the reality is you've got over 20 years of relationship building with the black community and her, the last name being,
but it sounds like it was both an asset and a hindrance then. Doesn't it sound like you said contradictory things there?
No, I don't think so, because when you're dealing with the different age demographics, because the older folks absolutely knew Clinton. The younger folks, I mean, you know, when's the last time we had a Clinton in office? And that winds up being, okay, well, what narrative do they get? You're talking about the younger voters, and the first one that they hear is Benghazi and emails. Okay, well, I don't know if that's true or not, but I do see the super predator thing. I do know about, you know, my dad's not here, and not all of them, obviously, but my dad's not here or has one strike against him because of this nonsense bill that was put out there in the 90s. So the younger voters definitely had, you know, more of a negative experience with Clinton. And I think that that proved to be the case in the numbers as well.
Okay. Boy, I didn't even remember how we got on that. There's so many things I wanted to talk about. We just keep branching up. So let's transition back over to the quote unquote atheism or skepticism movement. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this lately. I read the column that I sent it to you to get your thoughts. Thanks so much for looking over that, by the way, my recent blog post. But what are your thoughts? I mean, what is this movement? Is it a movement? Is it valuable to consider it an atheist movement anymore? Is it falling short when it comes to people of color? I mean, it's a big topic, but what are your thoughts on that?
It's always fallen short when it came to people of color in general. You know, I remember, not going to use his name, but he's a big speaker now. And I was one of the only ones that was doing the circuit. And he said, hey, you know, tell me a little bit about, you know, what you're going to be talking about. I'm talking about diversity, what it's like being, blah, blah. And his response, and this is from a known speaker, he says, but isn't that racist? I was like, what do you mean? He says, well, you're invited not on merit, but simply because you're black. And this was very early for me. And I was like, well, do I want to keep doing this? I mean, if this is the kind, and it was very, very early on that, you know, security was called on me and other stuff. Do I want to keep doing that? Because it's never been really hospitable to people of color. But that's true with America. So why wouldn't the atheist movement look like America, especially when you look at the demographics? You got, what, 90-ish% of atheists in America?
Yeah, it's
are
more white.
Right.
Yeah. The atheist movement's got to be way more white than the general population, even, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Which means it skews more white as well. So, yes, you do have liberals and you have a few conservatives and what have you. But, you know, even when you take a look at liberals, are liberals more or less racist than conservatives? It's like, well, when we look at, you know, some of the numbers, like, well, by 13 to 15%. And that was a 539 or 538, you know, poll a couple of, like 2 years ago. It's like that was the difference. That was the difference. Not a big one. And so, yeah, we're out there. And now you also see really big names just lumping what the regressive left is, whatever they define that to be, with SJW. So you have this anti-SJW regressive left thing. And so it's just completely lumped into it. So I may want to talk about things that are very important to me, like life or living and discrimination. And I get silenced, or I get, I have to defend anything that I say. Is like, well, that's not true. Did you know that more white people are shot than black people by police? It's like, I would kind of hope so, because there's like seven times more than you, et cetera. And so it's that and the whole colorblind grip that just exists there. No, we're better than racism, and so we're not going to see it, and so we're going to deny that it exists. So it hasn't. It's never really been hospitable. You've got really great names: Bandisa Thomas, Sigurd Roo Hutchinson, Anthony Penn. I mean, I probably shouldn't have started naming, because I'm gonna, you know, Ish. You have all these wonderful names that are out there, and you know, black isn't a monolith. You know, we don't always agree on things, and we go out there, but there are a lot of people that don't want to be visible and don't want to speak because we know what's going to happen. I mean, I curb my writing because when I put out a piece and it may be well researched, et cetera, just the amount of toxic hate and backlash that I get, you know, I go out and do the Thinking Atheist. I probably should not be talking about everyone else's podcast.
No, that's okay. You're on my podcast. Fine. As long as you're here and doing it. When you go on Thinking Atheist, mention my pod. Yeah, then we'll be even. No, I'm just kidding.
So I did that, and I almost had to shut down my email because of. I'm not kidding.
What was the topic that you talked about that triggered this?
It was reason, race, and discourse in the year of Trump. And I was just talking about, you know, talking to Seth about what I saw as the racial tensions and racial climates in the United States. This was also not too long. It was before Trump got elected, but also after, you know, my Trump rally experience as well. And we talked about it. And that's where I actually talked about, you know, Trump being, I don't know if anyone's ever seen Ghostbusters, because people, talk.
The old one or the new one?
Oh, the old one, Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I love my favorite movies.
Okay, so this is where I talked about Donald Trump being Viggo the Carpathian, where...
Oh, I can't wait to hear this. Yeah. Mr. Viggo.
Viggo. And it's because he is a culmination of all of this hate and racism, et cetera, that just this ooze that's slime. Just been the slime that's been part of America. This culmination was in Viggo or Viggo Trump.
Right.
Now, you know, people look at it and like, you know what, you're right. But at the time, I was anti-American. I was anti-white.
Well, I'm sure there's still plenty of those people who think you're wrong. Don't worry.
I'm totally sure.
Because if you look at the numbers, his approval has gone from what, you know, despite all he's done, it's gone from somewhere to minus one or two. Yeah, exactly.
He still has approval. And I also talked about, you know, interracial relationships because, my kids are a product of an interrelationship, and you know, my wife happens to be white as well, and I talked about that dynamic and that you know, I know the conversation that I was having with Seth and I were having this wonderful conversation, but when you expose that to the world, everyone else's biases. Yeah,
what are people saying? Like, what are the kinds of things? Because this is white privilege that it's so hard to even imagine that. But what are they saying to you?
Oh, that I hate white people. I'm anti-American. You know, the regressive left thing, SJW, so-and-so. I mean, I get some of that. Yeah. It's not uncommon that, you know, not from that one, but from some of my pieces when I write for Pathos, you know, I'll get a death threat. You know, every once in a while.
On Smalley's blog post, the comment that said Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization. So I'm sure that fine gentleman is floating out there on Patheos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just get all kinds of it. And the problem is not that people believe this. It is a problem. It's not the only part of it. It's that we do a really shitty job of policing and protecting our own, you know. So I'm.
Is it written off as the internet kind of thing?
Yeah, totally. Sure. So this also goes to demand. If people are putting out shitty podcasts, shitty blog posts, changing direction, whatever, they're doing it because there's a demand for it. And I'm talking about YouTube as well. We saw a big spike in anti-SJW stuff. Because it sells and people want it and there's a demand for it. There's a market for it. There's a market for the Rubens out there. There's a market from Milo. You know, I hate to cut in, but
absolutely was the thing that I don't know if you heard my Evergreen episodes, but the Evergreen College thing where people were like, I don't get it. Why didn't the students go out and do a media tour? It's like, are you? Because there's not an engine trying to drive a narrative for these students of color. There's an entire like economic engine behind Weinstein being able to go out and talk about how these crazy black kids are losing their minds. You know, like that.
Right.
There's a huge demand there. There's no demand in the mainstream media for like a college student to come talk about like intersectionality or something.
Right.
But anyway,
right.
Sorry to butt in, but it reminded me of that.
But that's exactly it. People are out there and this is what they want to see. You know, people reach out to me and say, well, what do you think I should do about so-and-so? It's like, well, if you don't like it and you've spoken out, then stop listening and have your friends stop listening, because eventually the unsubscriptions, whether it's financial or not, that's the only thing that changes things back. Eventually, if someone is doing this and it becomes a financial driver, I mean, you know, you look at Ruben and Ruben has gotten, you know, progressively more ardent. Same thing with the Amazing Atheist, who, you know, you look at TJ a couple of years ago didn't sound like TJ now.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's made his numbers, he's made his money over the last, you know, the last 2 years, you know, pushing up until that million. Dusty Smith talked about it, and I can't believe I'm referencing Dusty. But Dusty
I know who that is.
The Cult of Dusty. He was really big one time, and then he got really big when he was doing the anti-SJW stuff, and then he started talking against the anti-SJW stuff, and his YouTube and everything else just tanked.
Yeah.
It just collapsed.
There's no demand.
Not only is there no demand, is he I guess he took the other pill. It's not the red pill, the blue pill. And
Did he convert back? Just because I noticed my bank account was a little bit lower.
No, he became more approachable, a little bit more reasonable. He got back to some of his grassroots. And again, this is the same guy that that would make jokes on MLK's birthday. I'm going to celebrate MLK's birthday by getting fried chicken and watermelon. That was his sense of humor. I mean, and it was just...
Which is such a hilarious joke, too.
Tell me about it. I mean,
creative joke writing there.
And that was just the tip of the iceberg when it came to Dusty. And he switched, and he kind of did a little bit of an expose on what he was seeing in the atheist movement, or at least on YouTube online. And I was like, I can actually agree with some of that. Again, now... But
it probably cost his bottom line. It sounds like
it killed it
because that's why I worry about because I wasn't sure where you were going because initially you said stop supporting, try to affect and I agree that I mean people should support what they like. That's how it's going to be. But when it comes to a war of whose Patreon accounts are going to win, there's a lot of white people in this country.
That's right,
and it's so easy to make money off of that. And it's look at demographically. I mean, the white victim narrative plays best to people who have money, you know, who have the conservative narrative that plays so well to people who have the resources to support. And it's just such an uphill battle, I feel like.
But yeah. And then there's one additional piece here that I realized when I left the country, which is, a lot of this money, a lot of these views, a lot of these clicks aren't just in the United States. So they're coming in from out there. And so when you hear, I don't understand cultural appropriation or cultural appropriation is bullshit. And it's being done in Canada or in South Africa or somewhere else, Netherlands, they don't have the context of what actually happened in the US, but they have the money, they have the voices, and these things just resound in these echo chambers that just build upon build. And so when you start looking at, how many white people are actually looking at this and agreeing this globally, it winds up making, this little tiny minority voice of, an Alex or an anybody else, person of color that is trying to say, this is my story. The response that we get is, no, go away. This is our movement. And so a lot of people and I know that tends to be the sentiment of many black atheists that are out there, which is exactly why every time I go out there and I have this conversation and people are telling me that this is their experiences, they're making the case for things like black non-believers and black atheist groups, etc., black skeptics groups. They're making the case for that because silence isn't an option for us anymore.
Yeah. And I just am noticing the time and I have a heart out and I have to go pretty soon. It sucks because I really didn't even touch most of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. But don't worry, listeners, because I think I can speak for you here, Alex, when I say we intend this to be a bit of a series. I hope you'll come back. There's more to talk about. Let's plan on it, man. Let's schedule something right away because there's so much more to get to. And listeners maybe can take this first hour that you've spent on the show and can craft more specific questions that I can get to next time. I didn't even get to, I wanted to ask you about whether I should stop using the word whitesplaining. Okay, quick answer. Should I stop using the word whitesplaining?
I don't think so.
Because it triggers people who can't.
I know.
You don't think I should?
No. I think you should continue using it right now. I think that, we got another 4 hours of conversation.
I I got a marriage to think about. I got a family.
Five kids.
Why aren't you leaving sooner than I am?
Because they are used to this now. They're very much used to this.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Let's get something in the books again very soon. What do you want to point people to if they want to get more of you? Where can we find you?
I'm everywhere. No, you can. I'm everywhere. You can absolutely find me. You can find me on ABR quite often, actually.
Right. But do you blog regularly?
I do.
Okay.
I you can still find me on both The Orbit and Pathos, Graffiti Wall for Pathos, and it's just a self-titled blog on The Orbit. So you can hit me there on Facebook. It's Alex, A-L-I-X-A-L, all about the I-X, Jules, on Facebook. And there's also a public page if you just want to, when I am touring, I put my tour dates out there, et cetera. And also you can follow me on Twitter, Alex331. So there, and I occasionally put my clothes back on and take pictures on Instagram. And so you can always, that's an ongoing joke. It's just terrible, but yeah.
And most excellent. And where's the Starbucks Chronicles in particular? Cause I really want to go check those out.
I think I'm going to turn that into a series. But yeah, you and I are on Facebook. You can read the one that I put today, but if you just search.
Are they on Facebook?
They're on Facebook. Okay. At this point, I think I'm going to turn it into a book.
Ooh, that could be good.
Yeah. And Starbucks Chronicles and what I learned about post-racial America during Trump from Starbucks. From
Excellent. Starbucks. I can't wait to check those out. I'm going to search them out. All right, Alex, we'll do it again very soon. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today's show. Thanks again to Alex Jules. Great stuff. Fascinating guy. And I'm looking forward to working with him again. And by the way, I've got some really cool interviews coming up. Lots going on in Serious Inquiries Only world. I had a fun time at the Inciting Incident 100th episode. I got to meet Chris Cluey. And in addition to hanging out with, of course, Andrew and Eli and Heath and everybody, all my friends and all that. But I got to meet Chris Cluey and boy, that was a fun experience. We're going to try to get him on Opening Arguments coming up. He's a cool guy, too. So really excited to just be doing what I'm doing here. And thank you so much for listening and supporting at patreon.com/seriouspod. And with that said, I will see you on Thursday.